It was really a matter
of
I tried to get on the... I forgot. I just wanted to grab everyone. Okay,
can I get people to take their seats, please?
I'm working out. Make sure this is this one.
As soon as Jane is back here, we can start with roll call. Everybody got their caffeine and sugar?
Abramovich. I see you. Almond. Barnes.
Here.
Berge.
Here.
Bret Hart.
Here.
Cassio.
Here.
Cherry. Here. Kaufman. Cook. Dean.
Here.
Is anybody here on behalf of Mark Condi by chance? Brian Rasley or Atour? DiStefano.
Here.
Duke.
Here.
Fallon.
Here.
Gibson. Hanks.
Here.
Hardy. Hartman.
Here.
Healy. Hornig. Johnson.
Here.
Jolly. Lan. Larden.
Here.
Lawler.
Here.
Lovecraft.
Present.
Mahoney. Maxwell.
Here.
McCartney.
Here.
McDonald.
Here.
Meyer. Misra. Moser.
Here.
Newberry.
Here.
Peterson.
Here.
Radenbaugh. Rice.
Here, it's very quiet for teleconference. Is there anything that can be done on that end?
I'll give that a shot. Thank you for letting me know. Shawcross.
Here.
Gaia. Valentine.
Here.
Weber.
Here.
Wildfear.
Here.
Winfrey.
Here.
And do we have Tim Wilson for United Academics? Our registrar, Libby Eddy? Do we have anyone from Staff Council? They have their orientation today, so. Anyone from ASUAF? Danny can't be here for athletics today. Dean Lair.
Here.
Interim Vice Chancellor Dan White. And we have our Provost, Susan Henrich. How about our Chancellor? Is on his way?
As far as I know, he plans to attend. There is a matter arising, though, that's taking his way.
Thank you. And our Vice Provost. Alex. All right, thank you.
Jane, I may have missed it, but I'm here too.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think that was my oversight. I don't remember saying your name. Thank you. Anybody else I missed?
Thank you. Okay. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second. Any objections? Okay, minutes are approved. Please take a look at the agenda. Can we approve the agenda?
So moved.
Second.
Any objections? Okay, agenda is approved. Okay, so we currently have no motions pending. The minor and forest management that we discussed last time was approved. So that's a good thing. I just have a couple of things today. It might be a lively meeting today with the president here, and although he will be on the phone rather than in the room, we'll hopefully get some updates on various budget issues and other things. So should be a good meeting today.
Excuse me, can we work on the audio?
Can people in the room hear me okay?
That's better. With the microphone closer. It's really
okay, all right.
That sound over.
Okay. All right. So please, folks on the phone, please let us know if this isn't helping yet. Is this better, though?
Can you try again?
Is this better now?
I think so, yeah. Thanks.
Okay. Okay, so... as everybody knows, elections are coming up, and so I just wanted to mention that, talk a little bit about it. For those of you whose terms are up and who have decided to rotate off the Senate, I would appreciate it if you could help in recruiting good new candidates. And as you probably know, it's really good for the Senate to have a really good mix of more senior and more junior faculty represented, and oftentimes we have a bit more trouble getting the more senior faculty to do their bit, so to speak. So, if you could sort of nudge some of them, if you think they would be good, and of course encourage other good colleagues, so we maintain a really good representation, that'd be great. The other thing is, and that's not part of the elections, but for those of you who are not rotating off in the fall, so those of you who have been on the Senate for a bit, really consider in the fall chairing a committee that you're on. It's a good way to kind of get into Senate work a little bit more in depth, learn a little bit more, of course, serve on the administrative committee. And again, that's an opportunity to learn more and get a little bit more involved in the workings of the Senate. So please, for those of you who have some experience, consider doing that in the fall. But in the meantime, sort of going back to elections, I should have done this in a different order. Also, those of you who have some experience on the Senate, and especially those of you who have chaired a committee at some point, if you could consider running for president-elect, think about that. Again, it's a really great, very intensive experience with a very sharp learning curve, but it really gives you a very different perspective of how the university functions. So it's really a great opportunity. For those of you who are considering nominating somebody or yourselves for president-elect, your personal statements, so everybody who is nominated provides, and we have examples of that if you're not sure what that entails. Those are due on March 23rd to Jane Harvey. So if you're thinking of nominating somebody, please obviously talk to that person ahead of time. So they have some time to discuss and think about it. And then the election for president-elect is, as always, at the April Senate meeting. Okay? The other thing that's coming up, and this is actually where Debu is going to do some work. The nominations for Senator of the Year will be due, and that is traditionally coordinated by the President-elect. So you'll put together a committee. And so again, think about who you think would really be deserving of that honor, and submit your nominations. And I'm sure Dibu will send out more communication about that. But we have, after today, that we have three meetings left, so there's, you know, quite a bit of work left to do. As you know, the spring is always the crazy busy time. And, of course, this year is going to be extra exciting with the changes at the Board of Regents and budgets and things like that. Any questions for me before I hand it over? Yes.
This might be preaching to the choir, but with the changes that the university system and in our own university, UAF, is going through with budget changes and trying to shift alignments and priorities and so forth, this is a really key time for faculty and a key opportunity for faculty to be engaged in helping to shape those changes. So that's something that senators need to hear in terms of thinking about potential leadership roles within the Senate, and it's also something that ought to be brought up to people who might potentially be recruited into becoming senators. This is a really key time and a key opportunity for faculty involvement in shaping this university's future in a very difficult time.
Yes, thank you. Other questions or comments? Okay, then I'll hand over the mic to Dibu.
I actually passed today because you have covered everything, so let's move on. Thank you.
I, too, will keep my remarks short because I think there'll be considerable interest in speaking with the President when he makes his remarks. A few things I want to mention. My office has received a number of questions about the special program review process. And we will be releasing more information about that through various avenues. So if you're wanting more information about that, it should be available to you shortly. New Board of Regents members, I think, will be very good additions. All of them, in one way or another, have a track record of interest in and knowing the value of higher education. So I believe these people will be looking out for the best interests of the university. Final item to mention is I think that the Chancellor and or President may say more about this later, but the governor's budget came out last week, and it was more favorable to the university than to the vast majority of other state agencies and other state responsibilities in terms of funding. I think this illustrates the governor's placing a priority on higher education. Of course, we must still wait and see whether the legislature will share that priority with the governor, but it is encouraging to see that support in a very difficult financial time for the state.
Yeah, how many of you watched the governor's State of the Budget speech? It was, obviously a political speech, but still pretty interesting. Okay, while we're waiting for the Chancellor, I'd like to pass the mic to Dan White, who is the interim vice. Okay, who just joined us?
Hi, it's Martha Mason with OIT.
Great, thanks, Martha. Dan White, who is the interim chancellor for research. We thought that considering that we're a research university, it'd probably be good to have regular updates from the research administration part. So I would like to invite Dan to make his comments.
Thanks, Cecile. And I'd just like to thank you and thank the Faculty Senate for the opportunity to participate and learn and listen here. So I'll leave it at that. But thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Dan, are there any things that are big things that are kind of on your radar screen that you think we'll have to really deal with this year?
Well, of course, the research program review is ongoing. and Orion is the co-chair of that with Rich Collins, and we appreciate him doing that and also kind of the Faculty Senate input there. Next Monday, a week from today, I'll be in Juneau talking to the House Finance Committee. The person who's in charge of university's budget on the House Finance side is Tammy Wilson, and she has a bunch of questions regarding research, so I'll be talking about how research is conducted at the university and how the money essentially comes from the state and from the federal agencies to fund research and to fund the support of research, more importantly. So we'll see. Hopefully that'll get some education, I think, to the House Finance Committee most generally. Thank you.
Any questions for the Provost or Dan White?
Oh, I'll ask a quick question.
Please. This is a quiet bunch today.
Is there any, Representative Wilson given any sign that she's not really serious about a potential 20-odd percent cut next year for the university system?
As I think many of us know, Representative Wilson is a strong fiscal conservative. I think her suggestion was serious, but I also think that she does not represent the majority of legislators. And I will also say, as illustrated by Dan's comment, she's eager to learn more about the university. She clearly does not have as much information about us as some of the legislators with whom we've worked closely in the past. And the university is working very hard, and me in particular, since I'm in charge of some of these reports, to provide her with the information that she has been requesting.
Well, we have about 12 minutes before the president is about to join us. So on the one hand, this is a great opportunity to have more of a conversation with the provost, and I do feel a little bad for her that she's sitting there by herself. But again, excuse me, good opportunity to have a conversation about things that that haven't been mentioned yet. If you have concerns or questions, or if you prefer, we can keep moving down the agenda a bit until the president comes online.
I guess I'll ask a question. So we have been in CLA convening some special forums to talk about issues related to the College of Liberal Arts. And one thing that's emerged, which is not a solely CLA-focused issue, but certainly affects all faculty, but it has emerged in our fora, so I'll ask. There have been concerns raised about the new evaluation forms for faculty. Yearly reviews, and I wanted to know, I know that there potentially is a meeting scheduled between you and some faculty to talk about some of those concerns coming up. I wanted to know, I guess some of the concerns revolve around how those forms will be viewed as opposed to previous reviews that have been given to faculty when they come up for fourth year review, tenure review, or promotion.
Okay, that's kind of a multi-part question, but that's okay. I will be meeting with a group of faculty about the new annual evaluation process, and so I'm looking forward to getting input on that. I understand that people are not entirely satisfied with it. I would say that isn't unexpected because it is a new process, and there's usually a period where we need to work into these new processes and get them to a place where everyone is satisfied. I would say that normally your longer-term reviews, like a fourth-year review or a cumulative post-tenure review at the third and sixth year, are the most important reviews and the ones that people will look at most closely. However, I do expect that the annual evaluations will also be considered going forward. Is there any part of your question that I missed there?
Will there be some sort of guidance given on sort of how these reviews with their sort of new rankings of unsatisfactory, satisfactory, and good compare to previous evaluations that didn't necessarily always have those same three categories in all areas?
Well, I think that's a place where I can look to the discussion with faculty and maybe we can collaboratively come up with an appropriate communication about that.
Great. Thank you.
All right. So Chancellor Rogers, if you're ready, the mic is yours.
I am. Apologize for being a little bit late. I was at a Chamber of Commerce meeting. I'm trying to continue to get their support for the university, which I think is important, particularly in what's clearly a very challenging time for the state of Alaska with 60% of the revenue not there to fill the state budget gap. I was in Juneau on Thursday and Friday and had the first opportunity to meet with some legislators. They're really still dealing at the shock of the size of the budget hole that they have. I know the President Gamble will be on shortly and discuss his presentation to the House Finance Committee on Thursday, and he'll be meeting with the subcommittee this afternoon. I think what we've seen so far, given how big the budget gap is for the state of Alaska, I'm relatively pleased at the priority that the governor has placed on K-12 and higher education in giving us the smallest of the budget reductions among all of the parts of state government. And the governor's stated priority for first that the state agencies come to us first for research, and a recognition that the university took budget reductions in the last year. I think both of those are positives. Clearly, having people with university experience there in the room with the governor has helped. When I thanked him on last weekend for including some money for the engineering building, he said he has a very persuasive director of the Office of Management and Budget, which I certainly appreciate. That said, we've got a real challenge. I think everybody in the room understands the scope of the challenge. It's not easy to make reductions. Some of us were here in the 80s when we took 15% in a single year. It's nowhere near that bad. But if we look over several years, it will compare to the mid-80s. The only good news out of it is we made it through the mid-80s. We're still here. We're, in fact, stronger than we were in the 80s, and so we know it's possible to make it through. But I know that we will see people we care about and programs we care about no longer here. In the last year, we lost 160 positions. If we look at October 13 to October 14, our freeze date each year, we're down by 160 people on payroll in that year, and it's likely to be a bigger number from 14 to 15. About a third of those were regular positions. The two-thirds were term and student and part-time. I'm guessing the number will be somewhere around the same this year. That means we're not able to fill as many vacancies. We may have some layoffs. We're a people-oriented service. You don't do higher education, whether it's research, whether it's teaching, or whether it's public service, without people. And so ultimately, we're going to end up having to do less. We continue to look for other sources of revenue. 60% of our revenue today comes from other than state government. We're likely to need to find ways to push that up. We're pretty low on tuition as we look at our position in the nation. There's some opportunity there, but I think all of us are concerned about debt load on students and what it does to drive students away. We'd like to expand research, but our faculty are about as good as it gets in terms of research productivity, in terms of success on grants and contracts. So, you know, if we run harder, we may be able to hold on to where we are, but it's going to be hard to really expand that a lot. I am optimistic that we'll make it through, but the overall story is not an optimistic story. It's not an easy time for us, and I hope that those of you who are willing to engage in helping find solutions will do so. And with that, I'll answer any questions until the president is ready.
Okay, I'll ask a question. So can you just sort of fill us in on the timeline for announcing changes to programs or cuts or whatnot for the rest of the year as you sort of anticipate it? I know it might be a kind of a rough estimate.
Yeah, there are a few fixed dates and a few not fixed dates. The overall budget level from the state is dependent on decisions made by the legislature and the governor. So let me start with those dates. Mid-February, the governor is his deadline, the 17th, I think it is, for any amendments to the budget. We pretty much know what he's going to do, but he could make changes in the next 2 weeks, and then his number is fixed. That's probably a ceiling for us. The legislature is likely to want to reduce from that. They have until April 20th in their regular session, but I expect decisions to be made. The House Finance Committee is scheduled to do its closeout of the university budget on February 24th, and so that probably will give a pretty good idea of the range between the governor and the House as to where things may come out. The Senate would then adopt its budget sometime in March, again, with final legislative action due April 20th. In terms of any specific decisions then within the university in response to that, we will make some decisions over the course of February. Susan can talk about the timetable. I don't have it right at the top of my head on the academic program review, but in other programs, for many of them, the earlier we make decisions, particularly as it affects positions, the more we get in savings during the next year. So I hope to be able to get through most of the non-academic programmatic decisions during the month of March. In part, the sooner we can get those, those who aren't affected will breathe a little bit easier, and I think we'll be able to begin looking for those people whose positions are affected, looking for alternatives. But we're likely to continue to be filling the budget gaps through the rest of this fiscal year. Susan, do you want to go over the likely timetable for the remainder of program review?
Well, these dates are approximate because with a committee you can never be extremely precise about when they'll complete their work. But we anticipate that the faculty committee will be submitting their reports, recommendations about the middle of February. Then it will go to the administrative committee, which will complete their work within about a month, and then the final decision process on special program review will be at the Chancellor's Cabinet.
Other questions? Yeah?
I'm just wondering if there's going to be the opportunity for input from faculty on all these reviews?
Well, there are multiple different opportunities for faculty input. The programs themselves submitted a report for special program review, and that is the input from the faculty that belong to the particular programs under review. The faculty committee is the first step in the review and recommendation process, and so there's a group of faculty there working to look at all the information that the programs provided along with some institutional research information. There also, although it's not quite set up yet, is going to be a Google form for people in general to submit comments that will be looked at by both the faculty committee and administrator committee, and then in addition will be available to Chancellor's Cabinet as well. So I anticipate a number of faculty will participate in that opportunity as well.
So before I welcome the president, I just wanted to make a quick comment. I think the Faculty Senate will play a really, really important role. I mean, it always has a really important role, but I think it's going to be especially important over the next few years for a number of reasons. One is that, as you know, gossip spreads faster than anything around campus, and so I think all of us will have the responsibility of sort of finding ways to distribute accurate information about things and to help people understand the various processes that are underway, whether they're reviews of programs or other types of things. So please, you know, again, stay as informed as you can and help your colleagues understand what is going on campus. I think the other thing, the other responsibility as faculty leaders that we have, and I don't mean this in a Pollyannish way, but I do think that we have a real responsibility to help maintain some morale among faculty. I, like several of you, came in at the end of the desert years. I was hired in 99, and this was just at the upswing of the desert years. And so I really felt for a long time the fallout of an institution that had sort of scraped bottom. And it took a really long time to climb out of that. And it wasn't pretty at the time. You know, there was certainly a climate where everybody sort of begrudged everybody else whatever they got, you know, whether it was a new printer or anything, really, it didn't matter. There was automatically the question of, well, why did they get that and we didn't, or what am I going to miss out if they get that? And so I think it's going to be really, really important, again, for faculty leaders to sort of help folks understand what is happening, why it's happening, and how it's happening, which, you know, of course, doesn't prohibit people from becoming discouraged at various points, but to really help us work through these times. And I do think that that's a responsibility of all of us. And again, I don't mean that in a Pollyannish way. I don't mean to put a sugar coating on something that's not, you know, that's not pretty. That's not what I mean, and I think you understand that. Okay, do we have President Gamble online?
I'm on.
Great. So I'm going to hand it over to you then.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity here in sort of mid-stride. I'm down in Juneau getting ready to go over and talk to the Chief of Staff this afternoon and then brief the House Subcommittee this afternoon. We've already briefed the full House Finance Committee. But I'll start with a conversation that the Chancellors and I had with the Lieutenant Governor on Friday. We had a conference call with him, just the Chancellors and myself. And his interest, and he expressed it at the last board meeting, actually, if you were able to see any of his comments. His interest is in finding a way to use the university more productively. As you may know, we have an initiative that we've forwarded, for example, to somehow administratively place a requirement into the contracting process where when the state needs to have some research done, it will come to the University of Alaska first, ask us if we have the qualified researchers or if we've done the research, and then if the answer is yes, sit down and compete to get their money for that research, essentially, but with a slight advantage in our camp. And if we're not qualified, you know, we need to step up and say, no, that's not what we do. That's not what we've done. We really don't have the right people. We don't want to say yes to everything and then really not have it be what we're about. We need to be honest brokers in this deal. And if we are, I think our credibility remains really good, and we will get more of the opportunity to spread research across the three universities and potentially earn some revenue that, that in the past went out of state. So we've got that legislative initiative going. So we sat down with the LightGov on Friday, and he was just sort of thinking out loud. It was a brainstorming session, a small group. We were probably on the phone with him for about an hour. I think Tom Case, he was in Anchorage, and Tom Case was with him, and the rest of us were on the phone. And I'll give you some of the questions he asked that he wants us to help them with. And most of them are in the area of economic development and the use of intellectual capacity that resides in the universities to come to grips with the nature of the kinds of problems the state has in its various elements of economic development. And you all know what those are. They run the gamut from just plain political internal workings, organizational workings and things like that, all the way out to research and development in fisheries, for example, and workforce development in mining. What should we invest in? What should we divest? And so on and so forth. So his first question is, what's the right size budget for Alaska? Are there comparisons, or is there a formulaic basis? Are there comparisons with other states that have gone before us that have used good ideas that we haven't applied in our own state? Where are the analytics? When people come to us with ideas about the economy, where's the data? He's very much wanting to be data-driven more than we have in the past. And, of course, we came back and talked about things like some models in experimental economics, ICER, among other things, were discussed in talking about that question. Then he said, how can we compel the public to focus on core problems of the state? Macroeconomics instead of the details of one-off projects here and there and everywhere. What's the range of meaningful decisions? Is there another way to look at the permanent fund? What's the right size of government for Alaska? If government is going to have to go through some sort of downsizing, and it's not entirely clear to them yet what that might look like, and we're very much, by the way, almost a micro system of what the state's going through right now. The parallels are really amazing. But they're saying, if we end up having to go through a downsizing, what happens when we come out the other end? What's the right size? What should we be, without automatically assuming that we're just going to go out and grow right back to where we started this whole thing? He asked the question, could we put together a menu of what needs looking at? What are the most important things that the state needs to consider in terms of its economic short-term and long-term? Long-term being relative, and when we say long-term, nobody's talking 50 years, nobody's talking 20 years. In fact, nobody's even talking 10 years. Right now, long-term probably fades into the distance at about a five-year point. Could we put together a menu of what needs looking at? And he mentioned the permanent fund again, and tax is on the table. He made a comment that I wrote down, a university helps society to grow and develop. UA should not be afraid to take risks and stepping out on issues. He said the governor and the lieutenant governor will have your back when you do. But he says you've got to back it up with data. It can't be colored red and blue. If we're going to be honest brokers and maintain our credibility, it's got to be data and it's got to make sense, not necessarily to the entire population, because an informed constituency is an assumption we can't make. But if we can inform the constituency at the same time as we propose options and the way to go after reaching conclusions, decision-making with data, if we can inform the constituency through the use of our data and our research turned into a way in which it actually informs, much like you would teach, the state could benefit, and and people then could better begin to try to work with us and work with the state to look at their own future. And so he asked, when we're looking forward, who are the experts? Where should we get the data? And then we concluded pretty much this wide-ranging discussion. And there were comments made by the chancellors, and I had a couple of comments in there. So this whole thing went on for about an hour. And at the end, we suggested to him that we form a working group. He wants something that he can come back to from the university. So the university, in order to respond to that, has to have some kind of an organizational touchstone that he can come back to and use. And so the idea was that we could form a working group. It needs to have people who are in the right fields, people who get it, who are aware of macroeconomics in the state and the issues that the governor and the lieutenant governor are going to deal with. They're not interested in dealing with tactical issues or small-time, one-off issues. They're talking about the issues that will move the state and make a difference in the future of the state of Alaska. We're not all engaged in that. There are people doing research in very specific areas, for example, who are up to their ears in much more of a tactical or technical area. And so a great researcher in a particular area like that may not be the perfect person, whereas a professor in the business school or in management or in philosophy, there are several fields where that ability to sit down and think profound thoughts might be a better match. And then how do we communicate? And I think the point you were probably talking about just before you invited me to talk to you is probably one of the most important internally for us. Well, it's also very important for the state because things are going to happen very, very quickly. The House Finance wants to be done, over and done, and their budget completed by the 27th of February. That's a very fast train. When you consider all the decisions that have to be made between now and then, you're talking about high-level decisions that are going to have to be concluded quickly. They're not going to be strung out for a long time while everybody goes out and thinks about it. They're going to have data, but the decision is going to be made whether they have data or not. So ours is the advantage of being able to bring the kind of thinking that's going on the campuses as we build our own budget forward to help the thinking at the state level. But the communication, both the internal communication, for them it's the government, the commissioners, the staffs. For us it's the same thing, the staffs and the faculty. And then the external communication, we both have a public out there that's very interested in knowing what's going to happen. Everybody wants to know what the plan is. And I'll tell you, from where I'm sitting right now, the plan, whatever that is, hasn't come together yet. What they're looking at are trying to meet numbers, and everybody's got a meat axe out. The president's office for the University of Alaska has been put on the cabinet as an advisor to the governor. That's a shoe-in and an opportunity for the president to take advice from the governance system at a macro level, at a state economic level, and turn around and pass that advice forward to the governor as a position. And as they said, don't be afraid to speak up. And he was very strong on this in the first cabinet meeting. He said, I don't care if you disagree with me. I want to hear why. I want to see the data that makes your side more compelling than my side. And he said, and when you are, you will win your point, and that's the direction we'll go. When you're not, I will make a decision, and if it's different than the one you wanted, I expect your loyalty to follow through and carry it out. Pretty much a standard speech, other than the fact that he really emphasized, up until decision time, he really wants to use his cabinet. Now, that's been markedly different than years that have gone by where the cabinets have been very perfunctory and hardly used for advice at all. So there's an opportunity there for us. We've got the lieutenant governor in on the score as a co-chair. And so on the research side now, we've got a foot in the door in our ability to communicate to the front office the value of the research that we're doing across all three universities. And that's something we ought to take advantage of. And he seems to be very, very interested in participation in SCORE and has asked for more information about that. So let me stop there for just a second before I go on. And that pretty much covered the conversation with the LightGov. Are there any questions or comments?
Could you give us some any more? Do you have any more detail on this working group within the university then to think these, I guess I'm saying, big thoughts?
Well, this conversation occurred in the afternoon on Friday. I got home about 1 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, and I'm back here in Juneau again on the 6 o'clock flight this morning. So it is not gelled at this particular point. I haven't even talked to the chancellors since Friday, but we have a cabinet meeting tomorrow morning in which we'll discuss this, and maybe I can better answer the question after tomorrow. Anything else from anybody? Okay, let me switch to the briefing that we're giving here in Juneau. It's I opened the And if I'm repeating this for anybody that saw it, I apologize, but essentially it's going to be the same thing. The subcommittee for the House, and I think that's who we're briefing today. Yeah. The schedule's kind of full. The subcommittee for the House on education, only one member of the full committee sits on the subcommittee, and that's the chair, Tammy Wilson. All the other members on the subcommittee do not sit on the main committee, and not only did they not hear the briefing yet, but I don't even know most of them. And I've been down here doing this now for, I think I figured out this is the 14th consecutive year I'm sitting in front of these bodies, and it's rare that I sit in front of a group like this that I don't really know better. So the briefing that we're going to give is going to be a little bit more slowed down and not making quite as many assumptions for this particular group. And but the core of the briefing itself, it's designed not to brief increments like we have every single year with incremental budgeting. It's increments being we want to have a program addition on top of the baseline of our budget that expands our baseline. That's normally what the increments look like. So if I wanted to, a couple of years ago, for example, if I wanted to add an increment for advising would have been an increment for a couple of $1 million or a couple hundred thousand dollars, whatever it was, and we would have normally come down here and kind of arm wrestled for, you know, should we get the full amount, should we get half the amount, and that was the nature of incremental budgeting and what we did when we came down here for these meetings. This year's different. There are no increments. I mean, if you look at what the board passed in November, what we're dealing with today has absolutely no comparison or relatively little, if any, relationship to the budget that the board passed in November. That budget was about a 5% increase over the last year. Increase in increments, increase in pay and benefits, increase in fixed costs for our buildings, and the cost of maintaining them, and so on and so forth. This year, we still have all these fixed costs, and they're going up at a relatively predictable rate, CPI, inflation, whatever, or contractual obligations. But the problem is we're not getting any more money. And, in fact, it's going the other way. Utilities, for example, usually we hit a trigger for utilities and we go in and we ask for more money when the cost of utilities goes up and our burn rate goes up with new buildings, for example, then the state gives us the additional dollars to cover those utilities. Well, this year they handed the entire utility bill back to us and said, you're paying for your own utilities. So this year, as opposed to previous years, utility savings, turning off your lights and all those kinds of things, really becomes important. I mean, every little bit's going to help because we're going to have to foot that whole bill. There are no programmatic increments on the academic side. they've basically been all removed. And so the introduction to this briefing was, this is the first time we've ever briefed something like this. There are no increments. There's no money for capital. So we really don't have a briefing. And so what we're here to do is to answer the question everybody's asking me and the chancellors, what are you guys going to do to deal with whatever budget cuts you get? And so playing off 2 days worth of discussion with the board a couple of weeks ago, the briefing is comprised of an explanation of what our strategy is to answer that question. And the strategy is really pretty simple. We're looking at a period of time in which we're going to have to go through tough times. The budget deficit will eventually get fixed, one hopes, but it's very difficult to forecast that. Nobody forecasted what we're in. All the smart people in the world couldn't figure out that oil was going to go to where it is. So I figured all those smart people aren't going to be anywhere near that good figuring out where we're going to come out of it and what oil is going to be, much less the volume because of the reaction of the oil companies. So we just put out there that it's about a 3-year period that we're going to say we're certainly not going to get any better in that period. And if we do, hey, great, that just makes our life easier. But it's not likely, and so the upside potential seems to be limited, and so we're going to go with a 3-year period. The initial numbers we got over that 3-year period was that they want to look at us reducing our budget by about 25%. The two issues inside running a set of numbers that looks at a 25% reduction are centered around what's the number that I have to balance my budget with for FY16, and that's what I call fast money. It's money that you have to take out of the system right now. So if I stop a contract and terminate the contract, I don't pay those people anymore starting tomorrow. That's fast money. And then there's slow money, and that is if we're going to stop a program, an academic program of some sort, that's involved with teach out and repositioning faculty and those kinds of things, that could take 2 or even 3 years down the road. But you still have to take the action, but the reaction isn't going to occur in the budget for 2 or 3 years. We've got to do both. And number one, the short-term FY16 number that we're looking at right now is about $43 million that we're going to have to cover, for which we do not have the money right now. That's operating funds. This $43 million is compared to about $24, $25, $26 million last year. So we've had a year head start on how to do this for 15. And you all went through that. And in fact, at UAF, you went through it really, really well. You were very focused, very analytical, and the whole process worked great. So we've warmed up for this. The trouble is the numbers are much bigger. So you've got to overcome the FY16 number and balance the budget. But then if you look 3 years down the road, you've got to look at what's left of your baseline, assuming that each of the 3 years the baseline is going to be reduced consecutively in order to get to that overall 25%. So in our case, the numbers we're looking at now, and they could change, but not likely to change huge, probably at the margins. It turns out that the reduction is about $12 million in the general fund. That's about a 3.2% reduction in the general fund. So if I'm going to go after 25%, and I take 25% and convert it to millions, and I only take $12 million out in the first year, that means in 17, which, by the way, we start building the budget for on the first day of July. That's not very far down the road. So for 17 and 18, we just made the assumption that we'd take the rest of the millions that make up 25%, cut them in half. So that means we have to take a 36% reduction in 17 and a 36% reduction in 18. The 12 million reduction in 16 in general fund is a number that was given to us by the front office and is the one that the House Finance Committee is dealing with right now. So that's a real number. The other two in 17 and 18 are assumptions made on our part. But the point is, if they want to take 25%, there's only so many ways you can take 25% and start off with 12 million. If I go vertical under 16 and go all the way down through all our expenses, that's where I end up with the general fund reduction, the must pays, the fixed costs, our pay and benefits, and so on. That's the 43 million that we have to clear in 16. So it's two things we have to do: short-term money, and then what do we look like at the end of 3 years that we're able to hold on to and preserve and strengthen and not have disintegrate under our feet, that allows us to come out of this thing at the end in one piece and ready to recover with the state. And the core of that recovery clearly is going to be the strength of the faculty, the strength of our ability to continue the research that we're doing. That's got to be at the core. And so as we identify this core and the programs associated with the core, the part that's not identified in the core then is what's up for grabs, but it has to meet these dollar amounts. You can't come up short. And we have just never experienced dollar amounts of this size. So there's a magnitude problem of getting people to realize how big this issue is we're dealing with. And the chancellors did a good job of giving examples of the size of the kinds of things they would have to be looking at to add up to cover in 16, for example, to cover that 43 million. You can't say, well, we'll furlough for a couple of days. Yeah, we might have to furlough, but that isn't going to come close all by itself. What is the additive that will cover $43 million as opposed to the 28 last year? And you all and they are working very, very hard on this, but it's for us to convince the legislature we're not going to get any more money from them. That's not the issue at all. What we're going to have to show them is when we come back to you and show you what we're going to have to do, we don't want you to have a heart attack and have the shock of seeing things that you've taken for granted in the university put on the block. And that's not to be theatrical or over dramatic. It's just simply that the magnitude of what we're talking about is greater than we've dealt with in the past. Now, the keepers of quality, for those who believe that quality is a direct result of more people and more money, which I'm not one of, the keepers of quality is that faculty that I was talking about, is those researchers. We have to figure out how to hold on to that quality so that our reputation for students, for recruiting, for holding on to good faculty, for recruiting good faculty, that formula has to remain intact. And the institution has to draw together around the effort, in my opinion, that's going to make that come true. If we do, I'm really positive about how we come out the other end. If we don't, this will make the years in the desert all over again for a whole new generation of faculty and staff that have no idea what you were just talking about a few minutes ago, and it'll even be worse. And it will, as you said, disrupt our reputation and could potentially cause us another decade of trying to put the University of Alaska back together again. When I look at the list of first evers and best evers, it's starting to accumulate, and some of the national recognition that's starting to show up on an increasing basis, that would just be a disaster. So we feel that our job here in Juneau and the job of the chancellors and mine and our team is to go in and make this point, both individually with legislators and collectively in front of the committees. They have wide open doors for us. We've been making office calls. I've got a meeting with the chief this afternoon. We've got a real opportunity to make our point. and we'll just have to see how this comes out at the end. I will say that on the capital side, in the governor's budget, there showed up two items, an $8 million item for deferred maintenance and an $8 million item for the engineering building there in Fairbanks. And word on the street is the $8 million for the engineering building is really shaky. I have no doubt that before it's over, the $8 million for deferred maintenance is liable to be shaky too. But we'll see as we go on further. And we will, of course, advocate very, very strongly for holding on to what we've got in that regard. But there's almost no capital money for the entire state. And what there is going to match money for the federal government to a large degree. So for our purposes here today, I mean, that's the top line kind of discussion. It's a mile wide and an eighth of an inch deep. It's sort of the veneer on what's really going on. But I hope it's useful and helpful for what you all are up to right now.
Thank you, President Gamble. Are there questions? Yes.
I have a question about the 25% number over 3 years. Where does that number come from, and how firm is it?
That's the guidance we got from the Office of Management and Budget. There, if you'll remember, the governor originally said, you know, he was looking at possibly 5%, he was looking at 8%, and then he was looking at different time periods. The 25% overall has been fairly consistent through all that. And then out of that came our share, and that's the number we're using right now for the FY16 budget.
President Gamble, I have a couple of questions that are sort of related, I suppose.
Sure.
I know at UAF there's been about making decisions about potential cuts in a sort of strategic way, you know, not just sort of across the board cutting everything, but really kind of thinking about what needs to be preserved and what needs to be invested in. You kind of alluded to that a little bit. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the strategic decisions you see for the UA system. And then sort of, I guess, part B of that question is where do you see UAF sort of fitting into that larger strategic plan for UA at this point?
Yeah, that's a real good question. The summit team was formed to look at initiatives that seemed to make better sense if they were accomplished across the entire system. And so it's a good tool to use for taking a look at what, instead of just percentage cuts across the system, taking a look at what could be selective choices that could reduce the burden on the respective universities by taking something across the entire system off the plate, if it were, and applying it across the whole system. So for example, if you know, we've got this new reg for furloughs, how would a furlough across the entire system, which could save a lot of money? There's a limitation on furloughs. It's different for the union. It's different for tenured faculty, and so on and so forth. But all that has been looked into very carefully through legal, through policy, and so on and so forth. So the question is that a viable tool? And if we were to get so much money, if everybody, you know, took 5 or 6 days on a furlough, would that be a tool we would want to use as opposed to cutting a program instead at UAF to get the same or equivalent amount of money, or maybe more than one program? And furloughs are short-term money, so that might be appropriate for the FY16 budget, whereas programs, as I said, might be appropriate for the FY18 budget. So the summit team is going to be involved looking at the use of tools like that. Now, one of the other things we're looking at is what will the state implement? You know, the state has options too. And so if the state decides, like it did for utilities, that it's not going to pay for something and it's personnel related, And, you know, we're holding our breath and watching out for that. And nothing has been put on the table yet that's, at least that's been made public. So once you take those out, the amount of actual dollars then that each university would have to go find in its programs or services would be reduced, and up to the chancellors, provosts, the governance bodies, and so on, then to find the remainder of the money. So there's a model for doing that as opposed to just saying, okay, 20% cut across the board, you guys all figure it out. Let's see. What was the second part of your question again?
How you see UAF fitting into the larger strategic plan for the university?
Yeah, well, UAF, first of all, there's the practical number in terms of UAF. If as we grew and as we divided number, as we divided revenue up from a proportional perspective, UAF is somewhere around 46 or 47% of. I think we use student credit hours as the basis. And so we always divide things up. We divide the budget up on a basis of about 47%. Don't hold me to these exact percentages, but I'm close. 47%, 33%, and then UAS and system-wide both are about the same percentage number. So as we grow and pass out money, it usually goes out in those percentages. As we reduce money, that's the only yardstick we've used for over a decade. So what we're looking at is that's the yardstick to reduce as well. So what that means is the dollar amount that's going to come out of UAF is going to be proportional, just as it's always been. It's going to have more impact on UAF than it's going to have on UAA or UAS. Another thing that really I think has made it rougher on UAF is the degree to which it's encumbered by the power plant. That was a battle that was hard fought. Brian was very much a part of that, and he didn't get everything he wanted, and he had to make some compromises in order to get the power plant. But we paid a heavy price on UAF's part and on the students' part, as you well know, and bonding, and it's a very complicated financing project. So once again, you know, being the doctoral research university and being the oldest with regard to facilities, that all piles up to put, in my opinion, a greater load on UAF. And UAF is going to have to bear that greater percentage. It's not going to be even Steven across the board. But as I said, as far as the future goes, when you take a look around UAF, we've got some buildings and things that we need to tear down. We can save expenses. We're going to get a new power plant. We've got new science building. We're going to get a new engineering building. There's a lot going for UAF. So I'm very bullish on UAF's future. And that's why I say the research component of UAF is so important, because we are America's Arctic University, and UAF has a 10-to-1 ratio over UAA in terms of research. UAA is coming up in the world. We can't ignore that. It's absolutely normal. It's good for the system. It's natural growth. But they're not going to get where you all are fast. It's going to take a long time. And in the meantime, you are the principal researchers in volume for Arctic research. And that's not going to change unless we disassemble that research through some horrible series of events associated with this budget thing we're going through. And that's what we have to work here in Juneau really hard.
Thank you, President Gamble. This is Debu. I have a quick thought, not a question really. So, and this is stemming from your comment that, when we are healthy, UAF gets 47%, UAA gets 33%, et cetera, et cetera. Now, we are going to use the same model to just kill the healthy one first and then go to the weaker ones? Mm-hmm. Or how does it work?
Unless unless we can come up with a better way, the independence that everybody is striving for, the three separately accredited independent universities, that knife cuts both ways. In the years when we were growing and competing with one another for the same dollars in Juneau, it was almost like competition on the athletic field. And it's kind of like you get what you pay for. Because UAF is out in front, and because UAF gets the majority of what's available with regard to the attention, the funds, the research, when we draw down, UAF is going to have to take a proportional share of the drawdown. If we tried to do it the other way and preserve UAF at the expense of UAS, the rural campuses and UAA, I don't think even the board could deal with the backlash. It would poison the system, and it would also draw the ire, serious turns on the part of the two communities, Fairbanks and Anchorage, and then we would start this stone-throwing thing, in my opinion, that we used to see in the past. We've really worked hard to eliminate a lot of that, and I would not want to see that start again.
I think I may have heard you say that you are trying to preserve Arctic research, though, and I'm kind of just wondering how you see that working if people, kind of leaving and senior faculty leaving that are involved in Arctic research that are not being replaced.
Well, first of all, that's the chancellor's and the provost's role to determine what is and isn't going to happen with regard to that research. Second, when we get into a discussion of cuts, I've noticed this tendency to only think about cuts. There is a real opportunity with regard to our aggressive ability to go out and grab research and grab reputation and put ourselves at the forefront of a very competitive environment out there. And we've got the background and the credentials to, I think, be very successful at that. So that effort is going to have to redouble. We can't be passive about that. We're going to have to redouble the effort and be as aggressive as possible to go out and capture those opportunities. We've got good things going for us. You know, Sekuliak is showing up here real soon in February. We've got a chair position coming up. We've got the active research that's going on now in several areas. We've got this legislation in front of the state, which is receiving a lot of good attention, that says, you know, look at Alaska first, University of Alaska first, if you want to do research, and a lot of that research would come to UAF. So in this whole thing, we can't just sit back and take it on the chin. We've got to stand up and fight back for the things where we can possibly make a difference or earn additional revenue, and that's got to be a part of our effort. It's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be like anything we've had to do over the past more than a decade. But I'm convinced, particularly at UAF, that our reputation can get us through a lot of this. If the chancellor and the provost, and this is much more in their domain, because I'm not as aware of who these people are and which research efforts are the ones that are the most important, but that's going to be part of their responsibility to determine that, so that we can leverage everything we possibly can.
Other questions or comments? Well, President Gamble, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us today and to give us a little bit more information on what you see happening in Juneau and what the decisions are going to have to be. Not easy to hear some of this information, but I think it's really important for us to have that and to be able to work within the parameters that we will be given in the next few years.
Just let me say one thing, that I'm not suggesting a strategy of preemptive surrender. we can make a difference in this process, and we can come out the other end, I'm convinced we can come out the other end a better, more efficient, more effective university that will not just be going back to everything we were doing before. And if we keep that in mind and say not only can we preserve the core, but we can strengthen that and come out even better at the end and be more prepared to be competitive for faculty, for staff, and especially for students, I think if we put our mind to it, we can do that. There's no question in my mind, and I think we have to keep that positive attitude that this is well within our means. But the ride is going to be tough, and so we just need to knuckle down and not be afraid to do some things that we've been adverse to doing before. One of the keys, for example, I think that's going to be the hardest to deal with is the rate of decision-making is going to pick up significantly. It's going to have to, because the decisions will be forced from the conditions outside the university for which we have no control. And when that happens, the decisions will be made. They have to be made to the degree that we can get the team together and pick the tempo up to be able to respond to that is going to be really important to our success. So mentally preparing for that, I think, is very important. The fact that we've done this, you guys have done this, through the year 15, the year we're in right now, shows me that not only can we do it, but we've got a great head start. And it's a refining process instead of a standing start kind of thing. So whenever we're talking among ourselves, I think we need to keep that optimism at the forefront. I don't see anything right now that kills me that I'm saying this is impossible. Now, we saw one number, I'll just tell you, we saw one number come out of the House Finance Committee. That I looked at it and my first reaction was, there's no way. This is simply totally impractical and impossible. It's all fast money. It was over twice the number that I've been talking to you about, the $43 million. But sitting down with the leadership in House Finance and discussing this, that number went away. So I think reasonable people are trying to work the problem, and we need to work with them. If we do, we'll come out of this thing just fine.
Well, great, wonderful. Thank you again. So are you in Juneau again?
Yeah, I'm in Juneau right now, and we've got another testimony this afternoon, and then we'll come home tonight on that midnight flight.
All right. Well, I hope it goes well today. And we'll be looking forward to updates.
Okay, and we're going to be, but that's a good point, too, I forgot to mention. We want to pick the pace up of the updates and start getting the updates coming out in more near real time as things occur down here. And Carl Beam is going to help work that. And you all can help work it, too, with the faculty through the governance process. Our responsibility is to get the word out and get it to you and get it to you as often and as straight and clear as we possibly can. So if it's not coming fast enough, tell us to pick up the pace, because we really want to keep people up on the step.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me to speak.
Okay. Everybody take a deep breath. Okay, so let's take... almost 20 after 2. Can we do with a 5-minute break? Make it fast? Okay, thanks. My whole life is you say get up, and come straight into work, and instead I'm like getting up and like, oh, I'm gonna read at home for a few hours, and kind of my day turned upside down. Okay, if you could please return to your seat so we can get going again. Okay. Jane is requesting that if you weren't here during roll call, if you could please email her that you attended, so she, to make sure that roll call is accurate. Okay, so I would like to move on to the governance reports, and I know I saw Chris was here. Chris, still here?
Good afternoon. Sorry, I stepped away from staff council orientation, which is happening in one of the other conference rooms. So. I don't have a whole lot to report. There's a couple things. One is that last November we had staff council elections for our representatives, and I'm very proud and to say that that was our best election yet. We only actually have 3 seats open at this point, and we've never had so many people vote. I think that probably has to do with our current state of the budget. as well, a lot of people want to be involved, yeah, we've got a full house at this point, which is great. We also moved our meetings to Monday morning, so we actually met in this room this morning to kind of coincide with the setup, which was a little big for us, but that's okay. By doing so, we're doing our part to save some money because the setup is there for Faculty Senate, and if it could be the same setup for Staff Council, we're saving about a little over $1,000. So there's our contribution to help save some money. Thank you. The 2 things that were kind of discussion items for us this morning were the proposed regulations for the furlough policy. A lot more discussion about those than we initially anticipated, and so we'll continue talking about that. There's a couple things that have been brought up regarding that that there's some question about. Some good things, so we're continuing discussion on that. It sounds like you guys may be doing similar stuff. And then we had Carl Kowalski as a guest speaker this morning talk about the proposed mobile device security policy. In our exec board, we had we brought that forward, and there was a lot more discussion and a lot more questions than me or my vice president initially anticipated. And so we invited Carl, and he really was able to provide us some clarification this morning. So that was good. That's about the things we've got going on. This was our first meeting since Christmas break, so we didn't have a whole lot to discuss. Anyway, that's what I have. Any questions, concerns, comments for me?
Great. Thank you, Chris.
All right. Thanks.
Okay. Has somebody from ASUAF arrived in the meantime? Nope. Okay. Tim, I thought I saw Tim leave.
I'm Tim Wilson.
Okay.
So I'm Sina Anahita, and Tim Wilson, who's the faculty liaison for United Academics, has asked me to read some remarks. So there's 2 issues that faculty should be aware of that are coming up. One is there's health plan changes for FY16. These changes, which I'll talk about briefly, will be implemented July 1, 2015. One is the deductibles will be increasing. Starting July 1, the new deductibles will be $1,300 for an individual and $2,600 for family. Number 2 is there certain name brand drugs will no longer be covered. The 750 plan and the high deductible health plan copays on these plans will also be changing on July 1. I'm not sure exactly where this information is going to be posted, but it should be available for faculty. And then the other issue that he asked me to speak about, I'm going to read a statement that was written by Abel Del Tito, our president. United Academics is advocating for preserving the mission of the university as much as possible during these challenging budgetary times. Any administrative functions that are not directly related to the mission need to be reviewed and realigned or reallocated as appropriate. United Academics encourages all faculty to lead the way in addressing the budgetary shortfalls. That is, we feel that all faculty need to be involved in the process of budget reductions and make sure that administration also gets its fair share of cuts. Thank you.
Hold on.
Oh, I have a question on there. With the medical, there was another component in there saying that some of the reimbursements would be limited to, at the request of the, or at the suggestion of a major provider of insurance there, that it would be cut to 125% of the Medicare covered allowance. Are you familiar with that?
I'm sorry, I'm not. No.
That was part of the medical thing. I was.
Ken, all the benefits are posted in the UA.
I was wondering what the
benefits.
Effect of that would be because we know the effect of the the deductibles, but when you have a change implemented like that, going from 80% reimbursement to reimbursement at 125% of Medicare rate, how does that affect us here? Yeah. To what extent, what dollar types of effects do they expect to save on that? That's what I was wondering.
We did not hear what dollar amount.
Jane, could you speak into the microphone?
Yeah, sorry. In the Joint Healthcare Committee meeting, we did not hear what dollar amounts would be saving. That change was just was told we were going to make it.
That could be very, very significant for some people.
Can you maybe explain that a little bit? What bit more?
In the past, if you went to a non-preferred provider, your reimbursement was limited to, I believe, 80%, and now they're of the cost, and now it's going to be limited to, like, I believe it's 125% of what the Medicare recommended coverage is. And so, depending upon what Medicare covers, cost of our insurance coverage would only be like 125% of that, which up here in Alaska, where you look at the economic quarterly reports coming out by the Fairbanks North Scarborough, cost of a lot of our services is double what it is in the lower 48, and Medicare cost reimbursements are going to be based on national, not on our local. And that's why, to me, it's totally unknown. You have no idea how it's going to affect us.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Ken, that would be a good question for Erica Van Flynn. And also, I had a question for you, Sina. I think the deductibles you were talking about are just for the consumer-directed health plan.
I'm just reading what Cam
yeah,
gave me.
Yeah, those change in deductibles were just for the CDH plan. Sorry.
Okay, other questions? Okay, Jane, do you have anything?
I have UAFT as a new 3-year CBA, and we're just waiting for a legislative approval.
All right.
And then the Joint Healthcare Committee, we did not meet in January, but we'll be meeting February 25th.
Okay. And I know Danny's not here. Okay, so we have two new motions. Could somebody from Curricular Affairs, I assume?
I guess that would be me now.
That would be you now. That's
yeah.
Right. I automatically looked to Reiner, but it is not. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Brian.
So the Curricular Affairs Committee is bringing forward a motion to approve a new minor in teaching English to speakers of other languages, housed in the CLA Department of Linguistics. And are either Duff Johnson or anyone else from Linguistics Department here, can you come to, like, this mic over here or that one there? And so basically the minor is made up of a number of courses, which, of course, people from Linguistics can talk about more completely than I can. There are a couple of new courses. The minor does not add any positions or require anyone to teach on it that would be a new faculty member. But there are three technically new courses, although some of them are sort of handled in a very, one of them is a one credit course, one of them is a practicum that already exists that would have a second course number added to it so that they would be in an ESL classroom instead of a foreign language classroom for their teaching practicum. So we're seeking your approval. There's information. We've definitely approved this because the interest, as demonstrated by their proposal, which is included in the motion, seems very high. And a lot of UAF students who complete their degrees here often do go off and teach somewhere. And so this minor was seen as something that would actually be very interesting to a lot of UAS students.
And just to clarify, because the admin committee had a question about this, this is not a program for students who are foreign language speakers. It is for people who want to teach English as a foreign language. Okay, mm-hmm. So just to clarify that,
right.
to prepare teachers of English as a foreign language.
Any questions or discussion?
Hey.
The incremental costs are practically nil. The benefits are significant.
Call the question.
Okay, can I have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
Okay, any objections? Okay, thank you. The three of you look very good back there. Okay, the second motion I am going to hand over to Joni.
Okay, so this is a motion that GAC is bringing forward, the Graduate Academic and Advisory Committee, to approve a new master's program. So I realize that in these times of budget cuts, you might be saying, why is GAC recommending a new program? There's a strong need for this program, and also the finances are such that they feel it's not going to result in a net cost. So it will cost more, but there's funds identified to take care of that. And I would, not being an expert in this, I would like to ask actually Cameron to come and talk about the need for the program, and then Dean Herman to talk about the financing.
Good afternoon. To explain the need for the program, I think it's probably necessary to take you through China real quick. In that quick road, you have to understand that about 20 years ago, there was only one emergency management degree program in the entire United States. Since that time, up until now, we now have 40 undergraduate programs and about 50 graduate programs, or actually more graduate programs, about 5 years ago than there are today. And the need for that has come about as a result of the fact that a lot of things have changed within the social fabric of emergency management and homeland security today. When we redefined the program about 4 years ago for homeland security and emergency management, we had 4 students. Today we have 140 students. The obvious interest of a lot of these students, once they graduate, they go on into a civilian setting, whether it's the public or private sector, has been that they want to continue their education because they understand the fact that a graduate degree will allow them to have a quantifiable leap. They'll be a value added to their organization as they go on in order to better serve either one of our municipalities, the federal sector, or wherever they might end up going employment-wise. With that 140 students that we've had come through the program and we're continuing to grow, has been the fact that others, through reputation, have learned about the program, and we're getting an increased amount of interest each and every week, not only through organizations that have endorsed the program, mainly the FEMA Higher Education Consortium, but also individuals at the Naval Postgraduate School and the Department of Homeland Security's Homeland Defense and Security Consortium. Those two groups helping publicize programs that are out there and through reputation management of the students that have gone forward has really allowed us to grow a group of individuals that either have come through our program or have interest in our program through word of mouth. And with that, the MSDM and the interest that we've had in it, we were looking conservatively at having 25 students enter a cohort at a time, basically on a year-to-year basis. We're probably looking at greater student numbers than that at this point, if for no other reason that we have continued interest that comes up each and every week. Thank you.
Questions about this?
Yeah,
just a quick question.
Ask questions, yes.
just a quick question. These courses that are listed, HS, EM, F, whatever, these are all approved courses at this point or will be brought up for approval?
From my understanding is that all the classes that have been put forward by the for the MSVM have already gone through GAC and have indeed been approved.
Amy?
I think there's one more that has to be approved, but they've basically all been approved.
I was just wondering, how many faculty does the Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management have?
Currently, we have two faculty members, and the remaining individuals are adjunct faculty members that basically teach within the domain that they already work within, either the public or private sector. The master's program, once we develop that and it's approved, we'll have four full-time faculty members there that will give us the ability to manage more of what we do or have been outsourcing as adjuncts, both at the undergraduate level as well as what we plan to do at the graduate level as well.
And you don't ever have to see any of your students, right? Is this all online, the master's program?
The master's program is online. That's the current plan. But like the BEM right now, we run a hybrid classroom, basically meaning that when I go in at 3:30 in the afternoon on Monday and Wednesday, I have a cohort of students that is physically sitting there within the class with me. And then I have a number of students that are logged in at a distant location, because we now, are up to 28 states that have students that are actually within our classroom. And then for those that aren't able to take the class, the Adobe Connect system captures that class so that they watch the class and participate in it in as much as they were actually there. And then they still have to go through the assignments and couch that information in Blackboard.
So the four faculty members teach the all the master's classes that are listed here, all the HSEM 600 level classes?
No. Some of them will teach undergraduate as well as graduate classes. The plan is if you teach within the program, you'll be expected to teach both at the undergrad as well as the graduate level.
Is that on?
I think so.
So I'm looking at the budget, and because I've not worked with the budget before, I'm trying to understand the general fund, the $145K from strategic reallocation and $145K match from the School of Management. Are these new funds going toward this program, or where did this come from?
Actually, I'd like to ask Dean Herman, who said he would speak to the financing. He's going to give us a little presentation on that. He'll answer your question.
Well, maybe I asked out of turn.
Oh, no, it's good. You can ask whenever you want.
So just let me go over the funds in general really quick. This program is, at least cost-wise, is already paid for, and it'll generate a good deal of funds that go well beyond the cost. So we received initiative funds of $145,000. That's through the reallocation initiative program that's been going on for many years here. And we'll match that with another $145,000. That match will come from the BEM students. We have 140 BEM students right now. If they were all going full-time, that would generate about $1 million in tuition. Our internal numbers looks like it's about $750,000, in which we get 60% and then 40% support student services. We've also got private donations. We just received, for the MSDN program, $50,000 from Pogo Mines. And then we do other training around the state. For instance, we have all the TSA training, and that brings in about another $60,000 each year. And then on top of that, so the number of students we really estimated very conservatively in this manuscript, we should end up between about 50 and 75 students after 2 to 3 years. That would be sustainable. And so the new tuition will bring in, you know, if it's 50 students, it brings in about $350,000, and if it's 75 students, it brings in about $500,000. We have a total of a three-year deal where we'll get 100% tuition in because it's a new program just to start it up, and then we'll go back to the 60-40 split. So maybe I answered more than you asked me. But it's a money generator. You know, we're really, just let me add one thing. We're looking at 25% cuts, and I have pledged our school we will not lay off anyone. And we can do this, but there's a couple pieces that we need. For us, it's all about tuition. We need the Board of Regents to give an annual tuition raise of about 5% a year, and we need to continue our student credit hour growth. We've been growing at about 7% a year for 8 years. The MSDN program is a big part of that. And so that tuition that we have coming in is part of our plan. It's a faculty plan. It's really faculty-driven, and as this program is, to get through these 5 years and to not just sit back, but take the initiative to go out and solve our budget problems.
So I take it the program is not Alaska specific. You're kind of right. Yeah.
No, we cover many topics that are Alaska specific, but many of the students that come through our program end up going and working elsewhere outside of the state. We recruit quite a few students that come up and through Anchorage. They go through the University Fire Department. They get employment here within the state. Some of them go down to the lower 48 and work as well. So we really have a large student base. Basically, that's been presented to us as our ability has continued to develop to deliver both online education and within our hybrid classroom as well.
Would it be possible for a student to complete the master's program without ever stepping foot in Fairbanks?
It is.
Okay. So are you guys going to be advertising on Matchbooks?
Advertising
on Matchbooks covers? You know.
No, I have not thought about that. I'm still kind of getting educated when it comes to the use of social media.
Maybe I can ask the provost, since you will have to introduce any new programs at the statewide and Board of Regents level, what do you see as a potential response to this?
Well, as everyone would anticipate, the Board of Regents is skeptical of new program proposals at this time. But I think this one is a strong proposal, and it's a strong proposal because they have thought through very carefully the costs and the revenue, and they have a plan so that they are not going to be a drain on resources of any other area of the university. Something that Mark mentioned but wasn't emphasized, School of Management last year got a tuition surcharge approved for management programs, and so for them, bringing in more students has an added benefit compared with many other programs because of this additional tuition that they're able to generate for each of their courses. So I would also like to briefly mention that this is perhaps a somewhat unfamiliar kind of program for many of the people around the table because it's really a professional master's program, not like many of our master's programs, a research-based master's program. This is intended specifically to prepare people for higher-level jobs in their position for management and leadership positions. And because it doesn't have a research component, the faculty associated with the program are focused on teaching, and that shifts the cost and revenue basis of the program considerably.
Other questions? David, and then Julie.
So the other thing that comes to mind is in thinking about this at the statewide level is what the regents might perceive as far as how this interacts with the other two universities. Are there programs and or faculty at UAA and UAS that would be a part of this in any way, or this isn't redundant with anything that's at either university? Okay.
It's definitely not redundant. There's no other emergency management program at this level in the state, either baccalaureate or master's level. There has been no build-up of this area at either of the other two institutions of which I'm aware. So I think this can be a unique niche for UAS.
I think that it's very well presented, but I do have, in my mind anyway, a little stumbling block on the new faculty, especially with the budget cut atmosphere. Is it possible that faculty could be pulled from somewhere else or some other experiences that they're working on now within the school that may be not as priority? I'm just sort of helping.
Well, yeah, and you talk about being new faculty. It's really not a new faculty. We're not filling positions. And over the last 2 years, by the end of this year, we'll probably have not filled 4 positions. So it's really reallocating. So we fill two new positions, but we don't refill four. We still net loss of two. We're moving into areas which are more lucrative to us. So, you know, just like everyone else here, you have a faculty member leave, it's very difficult. Now, whether we can go into other areas of the university and take faculty members, you know, we're going to try to get the best people we can in these positions. Sure, if there's someone else at the university, you know, Cam will be the head of the hiring committee, and we'll take a look at anybody.
Okay, other questions? Reiner?
So you're saying the two new faculty positions will be reallocated from within School of Management?
The two new faculty positions come from the initiative money that we're receiving and the match. But when you look at the entire school's budget, to me, you know, I'm so focused right now on 5 years from now not being in the red. We're moving things around all over the place just to make, you know, ends meet. So, yeah, so specifically the two new faculty positions, one comes from initiative funds and one comes from the match as the sum of the support. But we have one budget and we just manage it as a, you know, budget in its entirety at some point. So for instance, the BEM program is making us $600,000-$700,000. So where's all the extra money going? It's not going to the BEM program. It's going to fill other holes within the School of Management. So we don't have to non-retain anybody.
Yeah, I think to simplify that, the net number of faculty in the School of Management, as with many other areas across the university, has been decreasing for several years, and that's because we're not getting as much money from the legislature as we need to cover all of our fixed cost increases. However, the School of Management, and they have special skills in this area, being a business management and accounting school, they have done a lot to very specifically project the costs and the revenues of this program and to ensure that they're going to make ends meet.
Other questions or comments? Ryan.
Let's see. So, I mean, one big aspect of this is getting the students in, and it definitely looks like there's a ton of the online Masters of Homeland Security degree program. I mean, if you have sort of a business plan, right, and it's what happens if the enrollment just isn't there? And do you have numbers like on your current students to say what fraction of them are willing to continue?
Yeah, so Cam can answer this more. Cam can answer this better than I can. The numbers will be there, believe me. I mean, we went to a bachelor's program of 5 students to 140 in 3 years. Many of those bachelor's students want to continue. And the reason this is so popular for these students, they will be continuing to work at their current jobs. And so they'll be getting their master's degree while they're working. And as they get these different degrees, they're getting pay increases at their positions. I don't know, Cam, if you want to add to that. But numbers will be there. They'll be better than we even put in here.
Currently, about a third of the student population that was queried for interest in the program has already indicated that they want to progress from the undergraduate program to the graduate program. From that, because several of these students have already graduated and, for instance, work in, say, the Anchorage Fire Department, many of them are coming back. Their superiors are saying, well, you know, my opportunities are to go to another graduate program elsewhere, and I can spend exponentially more money going to that school or program, or I can go to what UAF will end up developing that will be, you know, honestly, far more cost-effective in the long run than going elsewhere.
And I think I'll add one thing, which is I believe UAF's program was ranked number 2 in the nation at the undergraduate level. So we have a national reputation for quality that will stand us in good stead in attracting students. But also to address Orion's concern specifically, and this is in no way intended to be threatening to any of our existing faculty. This program hires term faculty. So far it doesn't have tenure-line faculty. Perhaps in the future it would. But at this point, you know, if it doesn't make money, that's probably what will happen.
Provost, I think Oran's more concern is that we are, and I'm not saying anything in favor or against, but what I understand is that if we put a program forward and let us say it doesn't function in a couple of years' time, then we have to kill the program again. That's a process. So is that what you're trying to suggest, Orion?
Well, it's just that if we're having to fire tenured faculty in one program because of budget cuts and we're hiring them in another, and it turns out that it doesn't actually work out, I mean, that's the problem.
Well, it's going to work out.
Yeah.
The money we get from this, I mean, is the eventually tuition we get from this will be well in excess of the faculty we need to hire. And that tuition, 40% of that goes to support student services across campus. And these students that are coming in, this is not taking it from your programs. These are new students. We come from 28 states. The BEM program is a partnership with CTC. Many of these students would not have gone on 4-year degrees in BEM. I think only 2 students in the MSDM program right now are on Fairbanks campus. So these are new students coming in. They're not taking any of your resources. They're bringing in new money, and they're helping pay for student services. I mean, we have thought this over for the last 2 years. We have to take some risk, but this will make it. If it doesn't, well, then that program will go away, but it will definitely make it.
Yeah. Well, I'm actually just wondering about the timing because I have to leave. Are we going to vote on this today? Or
well,
are we going to postpone it?
No,
I call the question.
We're voting.
Okay, I really need to leave. So I put forth the motion that we vote on this.
Okay, so we have a motion to vote on this.
Second.
Any objections? Okay, motion passes.
Yeah.
Okay, so what that means is what we have left is public comment. Is there a member of the public who would like to make comment? Please.
Hello. I'm Patrick Marlowe. I am head of the linguistics program, and I was asked by my faculty at our program meeting this week to make the following comments today. I have provided it. I have written it in the form of a memo, and I have forwarded that memo to Jane Harvey so that you have it in writing, but just really briefly, I know everybody wants to go home, right?
Yeah.
Or at least go teach. Okay, so following the most recent faculty annual performance review, the faculty of the linguistics program had the following concerns. The previous system relied largely on a narrative commentary and set of recommendations from the dean. This system was recognized as necessarily subjective, but allowed for meaningful dialogue between the faculty member and his or her dean. While the new system has an appearance of greater objectivity, air quotes please, in reality it remains highly subjective and is now less transparent. Some of the specific concerns and questions to the linguistics faculty include, how is satisfactory versus good better determined in the new system? How does this new system correspond to the existing 5-tier excellent, very good, good, satisfactory, unsatisfactory evaluations for promotion and tenure? Are there specific requirements for promotion and tenure under the new system? On a subnote to that, a letter circulated within CLA stated that faculty hoping to go up for tenure and promotions should receive good in all categories. Does this mean as an overall average for the years between hiring and the last promotion and the year during which the case is being considered, or does it mean every year? Further, does satisfactory versus good better differ based on where a faculty member is in their career, assistant, associate, and full? Is there a direct correlation between the checked boxes on the evaluation and the faculty member's agreed upon workload? And finally, how will the new system factor into program reviews prompted by budget concerns? Must a department have an overall average of good across all faculty members in order to remain a viable program in the current climate? As I said, this is in a memo form. I have forwarded it to Jane Harvey, and those are our concerns.
Okay, thank you. Anything else? Anybody else? Any questions for Patrick?
Not a question for Patrick, but just a comment too. That from comments made by various faculty in various departments, it seems that sometimes what gets rated as satisfactory or what gets rated as good seems to change from person to person. And the original informal system seems to, it was enough for the dean to say so-and-so is making acceptable progress towards tenure, and as long as it wasn't fourth-year review or tenure and promotion or promotion, that was adequate and you knew that you were going ahead. In this system, you have more than just a yes, you're making it, or no, you're not. And so the 3- or 5-tier system is not clear, and the criteria are not clear.
Okay. Other members' comments? Any other things? If not, motion to adjourn.
Sony and Gaxi, and Brad.